Welcome to the University of Washington's Political Economy Forum. We bring together diverse scholars, policymakers, and citizens to discuss current public policy issues, to inform the public about them, and to find evidence-based solutions. Feel free to visit our website at uwpoliticaleconomy.com. We publish new episodes of this podcast every week. If you have questions or suggestions for discussion topics, please contact us on Twitter at ForumUW or email us at uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Hello everyone, my name is Nicholas Wittstock, and in this episode I speak to Feller Bose of Indiana University East, and we speak about the logic and rationale behind the regulation of sexual practices in the U.S. Hello, Feller Bose.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Feller, you are a professor at Indiana University School of Business and Economics. You were introduced to me by Professor Tony Gill here at UW, actually. And Feller, part of your research agenda studies the regulation of sexual practices, mainly in the U.S. But interestingly, you study this from an economic point of view. How did you come to this topic, and why do you feel like economics as an academic discipline has much to say about this topic?
Thank you, Nick. Just a small correction. I'm at the Indiana University East, which is...
Okay.
So, yeah, there's many different Indiana universities. But anyway, I think, economics, broadly speaking, is a study of human action. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, right, I mean, sexual practices, it all falls under human action, economics... assumes that people are rational, they're maximizing their utility and so on and so forth. So I think the idea that, economists, whether people like it or not, tend to interfere in a lot of subject matters, so to speak. They tend to, so it's not really finance or the macroeconomy or something, right? They tend to use the economic tools that they've learned and try to, delve into other topics, whether it's religion, politics. Yeah, and in this instance, I try to apply what I've learned in the area of, sexual regulations.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So when you speak about sexual regulations, what exactly are you referring to?
Okay, so when I think of sexual freedom or sexual regulations, I'm trying to think, right, historically in the United States, for example, you can only have legal sexuality was only in a marriage between a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. And that was only... that was only sexuality that was legal. That's the only place you can have sex in, so to speak.
Got it.
Right. So that was, the common law, was focused on that. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to see, of course, today it's not like that, right? I mean, you can, that restriction is not there anymore. And so I wanted to see if I could measure that change over time. And, you can have sex outside of marriage, right? You can cohabit. Two men can have sex. You know what I'm saying? So there's lots of things that have kind of changed, liberalized over time in the West, at least. And so that's kind of, when I think of sexual freedom, I'm thinking of beyond sex within a marriage between a man and a woman is what I'm thinking about.
Got it. And when you speak about regulations, are you exclusively interested in what the state deems to be legal? Or are you also considering things like religious views on the topic like that? Or are there civil society actors that may have something to say there?
Yeah. I mean, certainly the way I'm measuring sexual freedom or sexual regulations, I use state level data, to mm-hmm. tell me what's going on, right? Does the state prohibit adultery? Does the state prohibit cohabitation and so on and so forth? And but of course, the community plays a large role, social norms play a large role mm-hmm. in determining what the state does, right? I mean, many times politicians, right, they want to get reelected, and so they kind of want to know what the people think about these things in many ways. And so they might, there are still laws against adultery in many states and so on, right? So I think it's an interaction there, because while I'm measuring what the state is doing, there is that's major aspect of it is individual, religious and so on, right? Civil society, what they think about these things that impact what the state does also.
Yeah, but at the same time, I would also contend that often there's a disconnect, right? Between what, majority of people thinks about topics like that and what the laws are on the books, or what, at the end of the day, state action, state law does or does not allow/prohibit, right? So, I mean, this is not like all that big of an insight, right? But like often those two things don't match up, let's say, because there is some sort of influential minority group that is able to impose their interests through the state on a majority of people.
Correct. I think that certainly is a factor also that plays a role, that when you talk about interest groups and so on, right? Mm-hmm. So there's mm-hmm. minority groups that they strongly believe in something.
Yeah.
Right. If you go back to if you think of abortion, for example, right, the exactly. legalization of abortion was in the 70s and 60s and 70s. I mean, that was a big push by a strong people that felt strongly that it should be legal. And then, of course, legalization of sodomy and homosexuality and same-sex marriage and so on was also pushed by a strong minority. So yeah, there is this interaction between interest groups, right? And also the general interest, right? Whether people might not necessarily want certain things changed, but they get changed anyway. So there is that effect. Yes, that's for sure.
Yeah, but also what you mentioned, right? Like a difference in the maybe salience or let's say severity of interest or something like that, severity of preferences, right? So like, as you were saying, right, there might be some groups that have a very strong interest in the topic and maybe a larger group of people that might, prefer things to be different, but their preferences are not particularly strong.
Yeah, right. So yeah, that's for sure. I mean, I think, some people, some people don't even keep track of these things, right? They don't exactly. care. It's not a big deal for them. And so I think the morality politics is, yeah, for some people, it's not a big deal. They have a preference, but they won't necessarily, they're not going to vote on that, right? They're not mm-hmm. going to vote mm-hmm. based on that topic for a politician for or against, whereas some other people who feel strongly about something might focus on voting for a politician that supports their position. Yeah. So they have they're more strongly aligned with their position. So yeah, that certainly plays a role also.
All right. What is your general impression then, beyond the observation that it seems that there has been generally a liberalization? Has that liberalization been uniform or only in specific aspects of this wider topic of sexual regulations?
Yeah, I think some states, for example, have not updated their laws on sexual regulations since the 1930s. I think Michigan is one of them. And they might be making some changes now, but it certainly haven't changed it. You know what I'm saying? So some states haven't shifted at all. The last I checked, even I think Mississippi is another state that hasn't done much changes. So, but a lot of states have changed. You know what I'm saying? They've changed their regulations over the, especially in the 70s and 80s, where you saw a lot of change that occurred from the legislature level. But after the 80s, things kind of settled down again, right? I mean, things are more slower. The changes happen more slowly, gradually, whereas in the 60s, 70s, there was a huge changes in laws. And some of that, again, has to do with interest group strength. For example, there was the American Law Institute, I believe, had put out a model code that for states to adopt when it comes to sexuality. And so a lot of states adopted it, and that adoption liberalized a lot of regulations, and so there is that. Again, there's this professional group that got together and said, hey, you guys need to update some of your laws on these things. And, and many states, they said, okay, and they kind of updated the laws. So whereas some states did not do that. And, like I said, some states, things haven't changed in the last 80 years, so.
Yeah, the other interesting thing being that you mentioned this at some point in one of the papers that you sent me prior to us meeting here, is that, I mean, in most cases, right, like even if certain states still have, let's say, laws against adultery on the books, those aren't enforced, in the vast majority of cases, right? So there's a sort of a quiet quitting version of not really having those laws anymore, right? Like they're still technically there, but they're dead letter laws.
Right. There are laws, laws tend to lag. It's a lagging indicator in many ways, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
In that area. So, It's kind of interesting because, I mean, today, for example, yeah, so adultery laws typically are not enforced. If you are in a divorce situation mm-hmm. and you have children involved, right? So the judge might consider the fact that you're committing, right? You could make a case, my ex-husband or wife or whatever right, spouse is an adulterous relationship, and that is illegal under state law, so they shouldn't get visitation rights, or they should get visitation rights. They're very restrictive, right? That the person can only visit, they can only visit my spouse in a public setting, not at home where that person is, you know, in an adulterous relationship, right? So those things get indirectly, they still play a role in, you know, enforcement, so to speak, you could say. But yeah, there aren't people getting, you know, it's probably very rare, you know, that somebody would get, you know, you commit adultery, it's a felony or something like that. I mean, it's very rare. I've heard here and there, but, you know, where a case might go through, but, you know, I'm not sure how it all ends up. It might not end up in where they get actually, you know, become a felon or something like that. But yeah, it's, and then today, if you think about the whole, today, we talk about laws being lagging indicators, right? A lot of states, for example, are trying to now impose laws on, you know, kids going through, you know, gender transition or whatever, however you want to term it. The problem is, right, you could say, well, the state was all legal all this time, right? But it was legal. Why are states making it illegal now? Some states, right? Because in a sense, it was never an issue, right? It was not an issue that people talked about 10 years ago. It was not a big issue. So once it became an issue, the laws are, so people are trying to, right? Some states are trying to impose restrictions on that. And so which is why it's a lagging. So it's lagging on the front end now, right? So they're trying to, some states are trying to put laws to prevent kids from transitioning. You know, whereas, well, what does that mean? It was legal 10 years ago? Yes, it was legal, but probably nobody did it. You know what I'm saying? It's such a rare thing. So, whereas today it's become a, you know, topic of discussion, is, you know, it's kind of come on the agenda of everybody. And so now the legislature is getting involved, and some legislatures are trying to stop it. So yeah, so it's kind of like a lag on one end. On the other end, yes, nobody's really, they haven't removed the laws on adultery, you know what I'm saying? Because, and it's not really enforced, so to speak, in many ways. So
yeah. Okay, so beyond the interest groups that get involved or sort of rally around certain issues, what do you consider important drivers of the liberalization of regulation around sexual practices that you've described? As well as, I mean, I don't know, I think it's fair to say that the recent experience has definitely been a increase in severity of restrictions, right? Or an increase in restrictions around sexual freedom, depending on how you define that.
Mm-hmm. What did you mean by this is more of an increase? The general trends in the last 40, 50 years has been, right? Yeah, more freedom, less restrictions, right? So
sure, but I mean, now you... Yeah, but I mean, now you have U.S. states reintroducing restrictions on abortion. You have, I don't know to what extent you would include these discussions over bathroom laws and things like that in discussion of sexual practice or regulation of sexual practices. I suppose that's not really the same thing, is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, yeah. So one of the ways I dealt with some of these issues, like abortion, for example, I tried to, when I coded this data set, when I created this data set on abortion for the variable, when I use abortion, I actually tried to think about, I actually looked at what were the laws. So this is some years ago, right? So this is before the recent Supreme Court decision. What were the laws? If Roe v. Wade was, so my goal was trying to see what is going on at the state level, right? So the Supreme Court could come in and say that, okay, abortion is legal, right? So Roe v. Wade, abortion is legal now. Okay, so, but the problem is the state level, a lot of states don't change the laws, right? They kind of keep the laws in the books. So I try to do both. I try to say, well, if the Supreme Court says it's legal, then it's legal. But if it's not legal, right? But the state doesn't change the law. In a sense, the state is kind of tracking, right? Some states did change the law. They updated the laws or whatever, but some states did not. And so I tried to track that more so than try to, you know, try to worry about what the Supreme Court is doing, because I'm trying to kind of get the preferences of the voters of the state, not necessarily the preferences of the Supreme Court. Does that make sense? So when the Supreme Court, you know, overturned, was it the Dobbs decision where they overturned the Roe v. Wade, right? My index, right, the way I measured it, nothing really changed, because a lot of the states that had restrictions already now, right, that's how I measured it, right? I measured that freedom as it's already, you know, the median voter probably in that state is pretty conservative when it comes to, you know, abortion issues. And so I kind of didn't change it. Now, of course, there are new states that are kind of reimposing restrictions, and that would impact, you know, that would cause, you know, less freedom in that area.
Got it. All right. So what other relevant additional perspectives does economics as a discipline provide here when studying this topic? Or what other links are there potentially?
Yeah, it's right. So what interested me initially on this topic was, you know, like economists like to study economic freedom. Mm-hmm. They like to think about political freedom. And, you know, so a lot of work has been done in economic, there are hundreds of papers on economic freedom. There are lots of papers of political freedom that have been written by political scientists and economists. And, but when it comes to sexual freedom, you know, I didn't really see too much written on the topic. Uh-huh. And so the question was, you know, what's the relationship between the two, right? Do they complement each other? Are they, you know, substitutes? You know, what's going on is kind of what got me interested in the topic. Many of the economists that I hang out with, you know, their intuition is they kind of complement each other, right? They kind of go together. Freedom goes together, right? Freedom is a good thing, and therefore all freedom is good. And so, but when I'm looking at the different states in the United States, right, what I'm seeing is it's not really, they seem to be more like substitutes, right? I mean, states that had more economic freedom tend to be more restrictive in sexual freedom. Uh-huh. States that are more free in sexual freedom tend to be, you know, like higher taxes and so more regulatory states. So they have less economic freedom. So my thing was, well, it looks like there is this, right, they're kind of more like substitutes. So I kind of started doing research in this area. And, you know, I also read a story that was kind of interesting to me. I mean, it was a story about, I think it was an anthropologist who wrote a book on some observations he made on wild animals during his time in Africa, I believe. And where he talks about how monkeys in the zoo, right? Monkeys in the zoo, all they did was they focused on sexual, they were very sexually experimental or whatever. I don't say they used to tend to be. Whereas monkeys in the wild, they did very little sexual things. They were all about, you know, getting the food, getting the berries, defending territory, and so on, right? So his observation was that, hey, I wonder, right, in the zoo, you're given everything, right? You're given food, you don't really mark territory. You know what I'm saying? You already got your territory and so on. And so there's nothing to do, and therefore maybe, you know, the only way you can do something is, you know, in this area of sexuality. Whereas in the wild, it was right. You had to focus on a lot of other things, right? So I mean, I just stuff that I started reading. Then I started reading Freud. Freud talks about, for example, you know, and like I said, a lot of, you know, like Freud talks about. He thinks that civilization, he calls civilization as a byproduct of repressed sexuality, right? Okay. That was his. He made some observations along those lines. And he said he's not sure that is worth it, right? I mean, is civilization a product of repressed sexuality? And that's kind of he noted that, but he never really studied it, right? He wrote a few sentences, observations, and then there was another anthropologist later on who Unwin, right? Joseph Unwin in the 1930s, who actually focused on writing. Studying what Freud had thought was going on, right? He wanted to give evidence for or against. He was not sure what was going to happen. Is civilization a byproduct of repressed sexuality, right? Is it a, you know, where you repress, right? Where you just allow sex to be in marriage, right? Monogamy, right? Strict monogamy. And what he found is that, you know, he did find that, right? He studied like 80 different people groups and about half a dozen civilizations over thousands of years. And he observed that basically when a civilization or a people group repressed sexuality, right? That is, they restricted sexuality in a monogamous kind of relationship, that they actually started expanding and growing and conquering and, you know, prospering, right? So once they started doing that, he said that at some point they started loosening sexual regulations, right? They started, initially they were very strict on sexual regulations, then they loosened it, okay? They allowed for beyond monogamy, right? So it's kind of what he observed. And once they loosened it, the civilization eventually started going downhill in terms of economic issues, right? They started getting poorer. They were not outward looking. You know, they started declining, basically, his observation. And basically, he said within two or three generations, the cycle of collapse occurs. You know, it doesn't happen immediately, he said, you know, but basically his argument was that economic freedom is, you know, what I would say is what I'm interpreting as economic freedom and sexual freedom is an unstable equilibrium is what he's saying, what he observed. And I mean, since the 1930s, not many people have really done any work on this topic. You know, the idea of what's the relationship between the two, right? It's kind of like died out with, Unwin, and I think Pitram Sorokin, who is like the founder of sociology at Harvard, he did some work in this area, but not too much. Yeah, so it's pretty much since the 1940s or 50s, you could say, the research on this area has pretty much died out, you know. That at least I have not been able to find anything, you know, where someone has done some more work on this topic. So which is kind of what interested me, you know, in trying to think about this topic and trying to understand, you know, trying to figure out what is going on. Is it really a substitute, right? Or is it a complement, right? Do they go together or are they, you know, are they substitutes, right? So that's kind of got me thinking about this project when I first started it.
Got it. Okay. So the idea that it is sexual or the regulation of sexual practices in some way related to economic outcomes or even more grandiosely like political civilizational outcomes. I mean, that's a hypothesis. I would say, well, what would you consider to be plausible causal mechanism here?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, yeah. So when I was thinking about it, and I was talking to an economist, what we'll call Austrian economist, you know, there's a school of economics. He suggested that I look at this idea of time preferences to try to explain what might be going on. So, for example, the idea of time preference is a measure of, if you want to think about it, is a measure of patience, right? How patient are you? Can you wait on something, right? Or can you plan for the future, right? So there's kind of like a number of factors there, right? So how future oriented are you, I guess, is a question. I mean, if you want to think of time preferences. But so when you think of economic freedom, right? If you look at all the rankings of economic freedom, is based on, right? Does the state or the country have low taxes, right? Does it have a stable monetary system? Okay, are property rights secured? Is the legal system fair? Right. I mean, those are the if you have all those in your country or your state, you are highly ranked in economic freedom. And so if you think about it, right. Having a good legal system, having stable monetary system, right? Those all are good property rights and so on. Those are all things that help you plan for the future.
Okay.
Okay. It's a very future oriented thing, right? I don't have to worry about my prop. Like if I leave my property, you know, for 6 months and come back, right? Am I going to still have it, right? I mean, I don't want somebody else to sit in and occupy it, and then, you know, I can't plan for anything long term, right? I got to be very careful. You know, I can't, you know, buy more houses. I can't, you know what I'm saying? So that's the idea of the future orientation and long-term planning is what economic freedom is kind of focused on, right?
But whereas it enables you to be forward-looking, right? So right. If my right. property rights are secure, that now I have the option of making an investment decision that may only bear fruit in 2 years' time. Whereas in the absence, or let's say my property rights are insecure, I don't know if the state is going to expropriate me. Well, I definitely don't have that option, meaning I have to be more short-termist.
Yeah, I can't think about, you know, am I going to be able to pass on my, you know, business to my kids, right? Exactly. And so, I mean, lots of things to think, I mean, you know, but when it comes to sexual freedom, right? I mean, if you think about sexual freedom, right? I'm going to use a simple example. Right. A man, you know, for example, who commits adultery, for example, right? What is he doing? Right. I mean, so the idea is, you know, if you're committing adultery, in a sense, you're looking for short term pleasure, but there's long term cost. Right now, you got to deal with your existing spouse. Right. You might have to go through divorce proceedings and, you know, your property gets split and so on. Then you got kids that if you have kids involved, then that's, you know, that also, you know, kind of impacts them psychologically. Maybe, you know, in their long-term thinking. So the idea is, or even homosexuality, right? I mean, that people get nervous when you say that. But I mean, if you think about it, I mean, biologically, right? Two men in a relationship don't produce children, Okay, so there is, in a sense, a shorter a time, right? Is a shorter time horizon as opposed to someone, right, who has family, grandkids, and so on, right? I mean, given today, you can have your technology that allows for, you know, artificial means and so on. So I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not saying that, but you know, from a biological perspective, right, you can't. There is a future orientation, is not there. For example, when it comes to like adultery and you know, and so on.
I'm not sure about that one, but I mean, I think I would even go back one step and say the analogy between short term. I mean, okay, so in the adultery example, I think you can make the case that this is in some sense a short termist calculation from an economic point of view. So I think what you're sort of gearing up to is the argument that you know, sexual practice regulation, in some sense, corresponds with how short-termist people are on that dimension, or how how much they're sort of oriented towards the future. I think there are some elements of that where that it makes sense to me, but when it comes to a preference over who you should be married to, let's say, for example, right, like whether or not you legally allow homosexual marriages, for example, it's not clear to me that that's really that's related to short-termist thinking. So we may just disagree on that point. But let's say we expand this slightly, right? What other things would be part here of sexual practice regulation that you think is relevant through the prism of short-termism versus long-term orientation of people at the individual level, right? Or I suppose, you know, society writ large.
Right. So, for example, like things like some of the other variables that I have in my papers include things like cohabitation, you know, or I think there are laws against fornication, right? So sexual relationship before marriage. I mean, I guess in a sense, you know, a lot of people, so those are divorce laws. I do have bestiality laws and so on, right? So I kind of have a bunch of laws that I track that a lot of people don't track, right? I mean, a lot of people, there's a lot of literature on divorce, a lot of literature on abortion, a lot of literature on, you know, homosexuality and so on. There's a lot of people have written about it, but the other laws that people that have it in the people haven't talked about, you know, like cohabitation, fornication laws, you know, and bestiality laws. And so, I mean, I guess I try to put this whole thing together as, you know, one large area. But for example, if you were to think of fornication, right, you could say, well, someone, you know, is not waiting, right, for the right person to get married and settled in or something, right, and to build a family and, you know, think long term, as opposed to someone, hey, I want to have fun tonight, right? I'm going to go to the bar or whatever, right? I want to enjoy myself. And, you know, and make a decision, you know, of immediate pleasure or something, right? So as opposed to maybe I shouldn't do that, right? Maybe that I could get an STD or something, right? A sexually transmitted disease that I don't consider in my, in the heat of the moment or something like that. So I think that's kind of the causal mechanism I'm trying to think about. You know, can time preferences kind of this idea of future orientation, you know, can you use that to explain the why sexual freedom and economic freedom might be substitutes as opposed to going together.
There is a dimension of this where I think I could potentially see the connection, but at the same time, it just seems to me that, you know, it, like, the relatively liberal sexual regulation ironically would create forward looking, right? So like if you allow more, if you allow, let's say, people to have sex before marriage, maybe people have children earlier in their lives, you know, and as a result, you know, maybe turn into more forward-looking people as a result of that. I think let's maybe bracket that and just say maybe there's a dimension of sexual practice regulation that gets at this idea of like how hedonistic maybe is someone at the individual level, how concerned with immediate gratification, not just of presumably of sexual needs, but also of others, is a person, and might there be some sort of causal connection between that and presumably, first of all, individual economic outcomes, but potentially also aggregate economic outcomes.
Right.
So how would that connection work?
I think the idea of immediate gratification or planning for the long-term horizon and so on, I think it does make a difference. I mean, people, you know, you could argue that people who go to college, for example, are thinking long-term, you know what I'm saying? long-term thought process, or they're involved in their long-term thinking. And hopefully the idea is, right, college will get them in a better economic situation in the future, you know, give them more opportunities, open more doors and so on. I think it's in a long-term thinking, you know, someone who drops out of high school or something and wants to work a job immediately, right? You know, that you could say, well, that's short-term thinking, right? They kind of want to, right? They want the paycheck or whatever, and, you know, not willing to delay their gratification. And therefore, from an economic perspective, well, then you get two different outcomes, right? The one person who went to college, you know, tends to have, on average, at least better outcomes than the person who, let's say, drops out of high school.
I mean, are you at all concerned that this... I wasn't familiar with this sociologist that you quote, Unwin. Mm-hmm. You said? Are you concerned at all? It just seems to me like when I read a lot of this sort of early 20th century or 19th century scholarship, it's very hard not to get the impression that people are trying to justify some sort of social institution and give it some cloak of, you know, scholarly... justification, right? Do you not get the feeling that there is potentially an attempt to somehow justify, you know, Christian-inspired morality through different means in some sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible, but I think my understanding of when I read the biography of Unwin and, you know, Freud, you know, I was not under the impression he was a Christian, at least not a practicing Christian. So it might be just the Christianity was more influential in the past, and so maybe everybody's under the ethos or something, right? I don't know, you know. So, but it was my, from what I understand, Unwin's reaction to his results was he was shocked to see the results. That's what he was. It was not like he was expecting the results. You know what I'm saying? Right. So there was a kind of the, you know, he was like, I was not expecting this kind of thing, right? His mentality was kind of thinking when he did the study. So, and that, you know, that actually makes a good case for why we need to. You know, we need people, more people. Like, I started working on this, but I think more people should start working on this topic again, right? It hasn't, you know, my reading of the material is that the literature is that it hasn't been worked on that much, really, since a long time ago. And why not work on it now, right? You know, today I'm sure we have different biases and so on, in a different cultural ethos and so on. But I think it's certainly worth, you know, looking, you know, in this topic and researching it. I mean, it is... Yeah, I mean, it is becoming, it's always an issue in the culture around us, you know what I'm saying? And even in my research, I've done a lot of research at the state level, the aggregate level, and sometimes the aggregate level results are not, you know, if you can get it at the individual level, the results will be much stronger, you know, in terms of, you know, what you find and so on. So, I think that certainly is a reason to kind of, we need to update some of the research, right? And try to see if we got better tools now, right? I mean, he was, you know, Unwin was a, you know, yeah, he did a lot more, right? Observational. And I'm saying he was using, you know, tools that were not, you would not, you know, it was more studying the history and reading, you know what I'm saying? That kind of stuff, whereas, you know, we could use more statistical tools today and so on, and I'll try to understand some of these things better.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a part of me that feels like it's plausible, you know, to argue that richer societies might somehow become more hedonistic because they can. Mm-hmm. And as a result, maybe somehow lose something as a result of that. At the same time, I just feel like, I don't know, it might just be a very attractive argument to certain kinds of ideologies, but at the same time, I feel like at the end of the day, what matters is whether or not this tracks empirically, right? Mm-hmm. From a scientific perspective, right? So that's what matters. So I guess there's two ways of looking at this, right? So one would be at the individual level and to try to ascertain to what extent you mentioned this in a conversation we had before the podcast, right? There's some relation here to research in psychology that that tries to evaluate to what extent patience in people, right, which is just a different way of saying, like, to what extent are you able to forego short-term pleasure for long-term gain, to what extent that be those kinds of character traits influence people over their lifetimes. But at the same time, it just seems important for me as a political scientist to say that I would argue that clearly, individual level characteristics like that are important, but they don't fall out of the sky, right? They're heavily influenced by political institutions, by cultural institutions, by economic institutions. So do you see a way to study this topic from that vantage point, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this, this is kind of this feedback loop, right? That's going on here. You know, there are a lot of people who believe, for example, norms affect laws, and then the people that believe the laws affect norms, you know what I'm saying? So I think it's, there's some, you know, there's some sort of a feedback loop that is, you know, going on between legal norms and social norms. And I'm saying it's just, there's this interaction there. I certainly don't doubt that's happening. And there's also, I think there's some arguments for, you know, people saying the Timur Quran, who talks about preference falsification, people might say they believe one thing, but once the field, you know, they're saying that something changes, then they're more forthcoming with your opinions and so on. So there could be a lot of stuff going on in terms of what people believe about certain things, and things, and those opinions change, you know, people's opinions change over time, I think that certainly is possible. You know, like I said, this is a topic that I've worked in, there's a lot of work that can be done in this area. So if other people are interested in the topic, certainly worth, you know, worth exploring. And it's an important topic. And I found really, it's really useful to kind of look at, in the literature beyond economics for me was really helpful to look into the psychology literature, like we mentioned, where a lot of people are working on, you know, that issue of patience and delayed gratification and so on. I think it's an important topic that's being worked on. And it's interesting, actually, just a few weeks ago, like one of the things economists like to always do is they like to try and Adam Smith, who if you, you know, the founder of modern economics. And, you know, in fact, I actually ran across something 2-3 weeks ago where Adam Smith talks a little bit about it. He talks about two different cultures, which is kind of interesting, he talks about a strict culture and a loose culture, and his terminology. So I thought it was kind of interesting that, you know, so he didn't really explore it too much, but he was talking about how sometimes two different cultures can evolve in society and how, I think he calls it the fashion, right, Adam Smith talks about this a strict and austere culture and how the common people tend to be in that culture, whereas the people of what he calls the people of fashion tend to be more in this loose culture. And he says the people of fashion are the people that have money and so on, the money class and so on, as opposed to the working class. So he makes an interesting comment in that area that I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, that could be something that could be tied in possibly with this idea of, you know, time preferences. You know, is he trying to say that? You know, it's possible. I think that's kind of what he's getting at, without really delving into it further. You know what I'm saying? So I was I was pretty excited to see that he has something to say about this topic, even though it's very little and not well developed either. So
I have two comments. So on the one hand, I feel like I understand that quote differently, interestingly, because it seems to me that he's making an observation that I would just term a little bit differently, which is that it's not obvious to me that people at any given point in time that are economically successful are particularly strict in how they organize their lives, right? Whether or not it pertains to their sexuality or whatever. But that it's, I would rather say, people that are more in economically challenging situations by necessity tend to have to be more strict on average when it comes to things like that, right? So, So I would rather say that, you know, economic wealth probably enables you to, in some sense, focus more on short-term pleasures, right? Whereas economic hardship forbid you from being able to do that. Sort of related to that, I just wanted to ask, to what extent do you feel like the focus on sexual practices or sexual practice regulation, is that a proxy for something, or is it individually, or is it in itself relevant? Is it the orientation towards short-term gratification in the way that you describe it? Or is there something unique about the regulation of sexual practices specifically that has some sort of effect beyond what it's proxying for, right? Which is sort of the orientation towards the short term versus the long term.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, when I think about this, and I've kind of mulled it over a few times, and you know, talked to people about it, it's you know, it kind of depends on who I talk to about these topics, right? Everybody has a kind of a take on this, but I think it, you know, it's a good proxy for time. Yeah, is it short-term orientation? I think it's maybe as a, you know, because I'm looking at it from a legal perspective, the law perspective, maybe yeah. more. I think it's in a more, maybe more what's going on in the state, for example, the culture, right? I mean, people say the Midwest, I'm in the Midwest, right? People always say the Midwest is more conservative and, you know what I'm saying, in certain things. And maybe that's the ethos here. Maybe the argument could be made that it is measuring some sort of long-term preferences and so on, and time preferences and so on.
So the reason why I'm asking is that I see the argument with adultery, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? I feel like to argue that some of the other things that you associated with regulation of sexual practices, to make the connection between that and a short-term orientation, I feel like is a little bit more, is more difficult. Whereas mm-hmm. if you were to, some, for example, think about, okay, do states or societies or whatever, what are their opinions on smoking, for example? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that smoking is probably mm-hmm. the best example of, you know, whether or not you're short-term. Oriented towards some sort of short-term pleasure or long-term gain, right? So,
right.
So isn't that a much better proxy, right? So, like, I'm just sort of trying to...
No. I would certainly, yeah. You know, one time I even thought about creating some sort of an index that measures this more holistically, mm-hmm. right? Beyond just sexuality. So looking at sexuality, smoking, you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? There's lots of other variables that we could probably, you know, kind of think in terms of, right, as a measure of maybe time preferences, better than, you know, sexual freedom, sexual regulations, you know, like even within the sexual regulation, right? Maybe adultery is a better measure of time preference than some other variable, you know? I certainly think that's all possible. I mean, there's certainly, like I said, I think those are things that should be explored more. And, you know, I've thought about, you know, looking at some other variables of time preference that people have used in the literature. So I certainly think this is something that should be researched on more. And I would certainly say, yeah, I think each variable that I have there, you know, in my sexual freedom index, it, you know, might have different effects. You know what I'm saying? So I certainly uh-huh. can see that as a possibility. So, yeah, I would not necessarily disagree with you on that one.
Well, then, Feller Bose, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Political Economy Forum podcast. Please feel free to listen to our other episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You might also like our special podcast on election security, Neither Free Nor Fair, which is hosted by Professor James Long and is also available on all major platforms. Our podcasts are produced by Morgan Wack and myself, Nicholas Vichduk. Our theme music was created by Ted Long. Please feel free to leave a review as we're curious about your feedback. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, please contact uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.